Our final case this morning is United States against Bolton. Mr. Root.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Ruth. I represent Eric Bolton in this case. I had the advantage of hearing the previous arguments and the court's previous questions, and I really want to cut right to the chase. The government has conceded the first three prongs of plain error in this case. This is a case where the judge said, I'd like to give you a lower sentence, but I can't, effectively, because of the guidelines. There really are three points I want to make. The government, one of the arguments the government makes is to say...
What is the evidence for prejudice here? What's the reason to think that the judge was constrained to give a higher sentence?
She said it. She said that... I could get the quote out of my brief. It's quoted in the brief.
But she said, I'm not particularly happy about the length of the sentence that I have to give you, but just for your and Mr. Baum's thinking, I believe it is my job to apply the guidelines the way they're set up and not to try to arrive at a lower sentence.
That's what she said. And the government has conceded in its brief that that meets the third prong.
I'm not so sure. Maybe I'm just influenced by the nature of your original guideline argument, putting Booker to one side. Because the nature of your Booker argument is that the district judge did not apply the guidelines mechanically enough, that you think that you had certain entitlements under the guidelines, which the district judge was being too flexible in denying you. Now, of course, if there is a Booker remand, you don't get any of the mechanical benefits of the guidelines, and there is a sense in which your client is worse off.
Well, I don't think that...
The district judge already was exercising discretion not in your client's favor, but against your client.
Well,
that was the basis of your main argument on appeal.
Except because she exercised... It wasn't discretion that she exercised against my client. It was a rigorous application of the guidelines, guidelines.
I mean, of course, Judge Easterbrook is talking about your criticism of the way she applied the acceptance of responsibility adjustment. But I take it her other the comment that you're focusing on was her comment at the end of the process. She thought she shouldn't give acceptance. She thought she should do other things. Obviously, she worked through the whole process. But at the end of the day, she regarded it as outside the correct application of the guidelines to give adjustment, but she thought the sentence was too high.
That's correct. She thought the sentence was too high.
And she didn't want to achieve a lower sentence by a lawless application of Section 3E.
That's correct. It was what she was saying is her particular view of the law didn't permit any lower sentence, even though she would, in her discretion, would have liked to have given a lower sentence. But the law required her to do what she did here, and that's a sentence of 235 months. So I do believe we meet the third prong because it's under the law, the old law, the pre-Blakely, the pre-Booker law, she felt she had to do what she did in this case. Post-Blakely, post-Booker, she doesn't have to do that anymore. And so as a matter of discretion now, he will, in all probability, it's a high probability that he will get a lower sentence unless, of course, she changes her mind. The three things I want to point out with respect to the fourth prong are, one of the things is the government's been saying is, it's fair, it's not a problem of fairness because this sentence was fair under the old system. That is a backwards approach. The question is not, was the sentence fair? The question is, was the process fair? Really, this argument that the government makes is saying, well, it was fair under the old system. That's basically like saying, we don't like Booker. We like the old system. But we're not under the old system. We have a new system. And you know, for better or for worse, the old system has been dismantled. And so the question now is, in light of the old system being dismantled,
is...
Maybe too harsh.
Much too strong.
Too strong.
Word.
Maybe too strong.
Saying that district judges have to follow the very same system as before, but have a little extra discretion, is rather different from dismantling something.
Well, I would phrase it a little bit differently, that they have to follow the same system as before. But the bottom line is, the judge, in Judge Crabb's situation that she was in this case, the judge who wants to give a lower sentence but is constrained by the guidelines, that judge is now free.
Right, and you know, looking forward, suppose it goes back to Judge Crabb, and she takes another look at the whole record, and she actually thinks, you know what, I think the guidelines really did produce a reasonable sentence here. I've now studied the whole thing further. It may not happen in your case, but it's going to happen in some cases. And then it comes back up. It's my understanding, under our new world, it would be difficult to convince a court of appeals that a sentence that follows the guidelines is an unreasonable sentence. It's not impossible. I mean, that's one of the things that Booker does, but I really think that's likely to be an uphill battle. Sentences outside the guidelines may also be reasonable sentences. That's the difference that I perceive going forward. You know, and your case, of course, is stuck here in this interim period of time when we're trying to work through these things, and so you're having to roll the dice and hope that indications like Judge Crabb's might mean that a lower sentence. And of course, this is a drug case, so maybe you're right.
Your Honor, I think you're correct, and that's essentially the argument that I made with respect to the acceptance of responsibility. I'm asking you to send it back because I think I should say I asked you to send it back because I think she applied the guidelines wrong. But I have to concede that even if she applies them correctly, she has the discretion to deny him acceptance of responsibility. And that there's nothing I can do about that outside of lobbying my congressman to change things.
He doesn't seem like somebody who accepted responsibility if he's giving instructions on how to manufacture methamphetamine from the jail.
Well, he wasn't actually giving instructions. I won't split hairs on that, but I will concede that...
Still in the business, it seemed.
I will concede that it was not his finest moment in the jail when he... got into the new criminal conduct, but since then he has radically changed, and I won't go into all the details of how he's changed, and I think I'll be able to show that to Judge Crabb, and I hope that I'll have the opportunity. Another thing that I'd like to point out with respect to the fourth prong is the government says, well, the evidence is overwhelming. I really have two points to make with respect to that. That's just wrong from the standpoint when you're talking about the fourth prong, the question isn't the strength of the evidence. The question is the exercise of the court's discretion. In the case of overwhelming evidence in favor of, say, applying a certain guideline, the judge now has the discretion to go below that, to give a sentence below that. So even in the face of overwhelming evidence, the judge now has the power to give a lesser sentence. That's really what you need to focus on when you're asking the question of fairness and the fourth prong. The third point that I'd like to make is that when we're talking about public's perception of this court in the criminal justice system, we're talking about the fairness of the system. If we have a handful of circuits who say it's plain air, it's unfair, it's a substantial right, and then we have a circuit over here who says it's fair enough for us, I think that, you know, that unfortunately we get the maybe we.
Sorry, you've already got that.
Well, and
the 11th Circuit has essentially said.
You're right.
Booker problems are never plain error.
You're right. Now,
the Sixth Circuit has come down firmly on both sides of the issue.
And that is something that we should avoid. I think that when you because the...
Yeah,
the
if we're going to take multiple positions, we should have at least three to make it more interesting.
No, I'm not saying when you have courts, some courts saying this is unjust, this is unfair, and then other courts say it's good enough for us, that's what you want to avoid. Now, maybe I'm splitting intellectual hairs here, but the reason why the 11th Circuit said it's not plain air is on the third prong, not on the fairness prong. And I'm not sure that there's a lot of people who are actually going to read that decision from the general public and split this hair. But there is a difference there. I'm talking about courts saying it's unfair, and then another court saying it is fair. That should be avoided.
And do you have any insight into how Justice Ginsburg views this?
I wish I did.
Because there are four justices who think that there are problems in all of these cases, four justices who think there are problems in none, and then there's Justice Ginsburg.
I thought I had insight after Blakely, but it turns out I was
wrong. You did not write an opinion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Back for your
again.
Second try, Mr. O'Shea.
Yes, Tim O'Shea for the United States. It seems to me, and we're going to focus in on the fourth prong as well. It seems to me that there are two components, if we think about it, of what the fourth prong means. There's a systemic part of it where we say, well, the process has been used since 1987 and all that. And the Supreme Court said it was fine. And then there's the other systemic concern that says, well, the Booker opinion really didn't change things that much. It injected, as we said, as the court has said, in another context, in McReynolds, to say, hey, look, it didn't really change things that much. What we've changed is we're injected some flexibility in the system, but otherwise the courts are still making the same choices and still applying the same standard.
But, of course, you know, in McReynolds, I just can't resist saying, since Justice, the Supreme Court has made it quite clear that finality is an important feature of our criminal justice system, of our legal system as a whole, and collateral application has a tremendous effect on finality, that even, this is a pending case after all. It may not have been actually raised, may have been forfeited in the district court, but I really think it's a mistake to take something so motivated by finality concerns and just export it and put it into a different context.
And that is a fair observation, but those in any event are the basket of systemic concerns. And then there's the proof component of it. And think about the Cotton case, Your Honor. In Cotton, the Supreme Court said, look, these folks were not charged with dealing more than 50 grams of cocaine base, but, you know, the evidence is so overwhelming.
But, you know, the situation with the Apprendi errors is rather different, because I think there certainly were, or let me put it this way, I have no problem at all with the substantial body of cases where an Apprendi error had not been raised in, you know, or Jones or whatever it would have been called before that, had not been raised in the district court. And the question was, is it so clear in the record that somebody had, let's say, more than 5 grams of crack or more than 50 grams of cocaine or whatever it was? You could tell that from the record sometimes. Sometimes it was virtually conceded. And when it was just a single marker,
right,
that is possible to administer. When you're asking instead the far more difficult question about exercises of discretion, where there's a whole universe of possible outcomes, it doesn't strike me as the same question, the same problem.
I guess what you're saying, if it's readily quantifiable, then
is it greater than 50? And you'd have these people, you know, who are unloading, you know, truckfuls of cocaine. You say, yeah, of course it's greater than 50. So the statutory maximum popped up to 40, or popped up to life, and that's all you had to worry about.
I think that makes perfect sense.
But we're in a different situation, right?
No,
absolutely,
now
we are.
Now we're in a different situation, and you are opposed to a remand that would find out whether it made a difference.
No, well, that's a third prong analysis, Your Honor. But in this case, are the things we're arguing about, are they readily quantifiable? Well, did the guy accept responsibility or not for his crime? As the court points out, the quantum of proof on that is pretty high. He pled guilty to actually conspiring to manufacture methamphetamine again. We met the highest burden there because he pled guilty to it. And the district court reasonably concluded that he failed to accept responsibility for his crime. The other hotly contested point is the
you
guns.
See, that may be true, but okay. To be fair, Mr. Ruth, the comments the district judge made about her sense that the sentence was way too high was, let's say, a net comment. It was at the end of the process, and she'd come up with the sentence, and she said, I am being forced to impose a sentence that's too high.
Right.
It wasn't about whether she wished she could have given. I think she's perfectly happy not to give him acceptance of responsibility, but drug quantity, of course, is usually the big driver on where these sentences are.
Right. And
type.
Absolutely. But what's contested here are acceptance of responsibility, whether there are guns involved, whether there are weapons involved. And the defendant had 3 firearms in his home, at least 4 caches of ammunition. He had a loaded Glock in his storage area, and he's got drug stuff all over the place. Now, the defense may argue, well, you know, we're not sure whether he lived there or not. He was caught in Texas a month later. Well, it was in the pre-sentence report that that's where he lived in paragraph 46, and the defendant did not object to that point. So that is readily quantifiable. As quantifiable as your drug example, Your Honor. And then the third one
But that's the thing. I mean, you know, if this is, of course, yet to be determined. And as I understand it, Senator Specter has said he's going to be watching this and try to let things percolate for a while. I noticed that in the paper for the other day, and you know, we'll see. But some district judges, I think it's inevitable, are going to be giving lower sentences in drug cases than the guideline calculation would have led them to.
Sure.
You know, and maybe higher sentences in child pornography cases, or higher sentences in.
Of course, the long run,
you know,
maybe
whatever.
More mandatory minimum sentences, which are outside Booker.
Yeah,
at the moment.
But
yeah.
The long run equilibrium is hard for us to see, and not really relevant in this case.
No. Who knows what the long term will give us? I think, happily for Your Honors, you'll probably see less assistant U.S. attorneys, given that it will be the reasonableness standard, and that'll be, I think, basically an abuse of discretion. So that net gain for you, perhaps.
We'll see every criminal defendant.
If you're predicting that in the wake of Booker there will be fewer appeals by defendants and fewer appeals by the Solicitor General, I think you've got the wrong sign on the variable.
Well, we'll see.
Because
we'll
see. It used to be that defendants really knew they couldn't appeal, and we'd get Anders briefs. If their only complaint was about a sentence inside a range, we'd say as long as the district judge properly calculated the range, we have no jurisdiction even to look at that. Now everything's up for grabs.
Well, 5-10 years down the road, one of us will be right.
We'll see. I hope you are. That would be great.
In any event, the things that are contested are definable things, are quantifiable things. In the court made the right decision. And then that brings us, kind of sneaks us back a smidge to the systemic things. Is it, are the 2 points a big enough deal to affect the judicial integrity? Of the proceedings, you know, that's up to you. That's your call. But I would respectfully submit that it's not. I appreciate the court's attention. It's been a wonderful talking with you this morning. Take care now.
Anything further, Mr. Ruth?
Just one point. The government says that the evidence is overwhelming with respect to the gun. I mean, before Booker, I was arguing that the evidence was insufficient on the gun, and I still think it is. They proved that the guns were in the house. But they didn't prove that he possessed them. They didn't prove he knew they were in the house. They didn't prove that they were in the house when he was there. There are a lot of witnesses.
I think they winked out of this space-time continuum whenever he walked into the house?
No.
We live in parallel universes. The gun floated into a parallel universe as soon as he got to the house?
We don't have these points of reference. What we have is when these people saw him in the house, there were a lot of people. There's a lot of evidence to show
guns
that
guns were in the storage locker where he had his place of business.
Well, but everyone who was there who talks about him, no one mentioned seeing him with a gun, seeing him around a gun, or seeing guns there. Then he leaves, and the government says he fled, whatever, he's gone. And thereafter, guns show up. Well, we can be suspicious.
We have your position.
Okay,
Mr. Rubin.
Thank you.
We appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment and your assistance both to your client and to the court. And we will, of course, have all Booker problems resolved by this time tomorrow morning. Or not. Maybe we'll be quite that fast. Thank you very much. The case is under advisement. The court's in recess until tomorrow.